This is David J. Martz, Jr., Public Programs and Humanities Projects for Recorded Sound in Libraries and Archives. Is this a division of the NEH?
It's a program within a division of the NEH. We will be talking about that.
Okay, good. We'll find out where in the hierarchy this fits in. And I'm so glad that David made the trip up from Washington today to do this, and he'll be having to leave right after the session to go back to catch the train. David's background is in history. He's got a PhD in history from Duke University, and he earned his master's in library science from University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He's, among other things, he's got 10 years of experience working as a rare books and manuscripts librarian before going to the NEH, and he's been 7 years at the NEH. David remarks what he likes best about his job is teaching open-minded people how to write competitive grant proposals. And we are open-minded. Okay, so let's welcome David Martz.
Thank you.
Everybody knows that right after lunch, you may be so open-minded that you're right out there somewhere. That's okay. I won't take it personally if I see that happening. My title, as recorded, the title of my talk, as recorded in your program, is something horribly dull. So I've changed it, and anybody taking impeccable notes should now be ready to get this down. My new title today is Sound as Humanities Text, Shaking the NEH Ketchup Bottle. Now, what could he mean by that? I'm going to be talking about poetry a little later on. I know nothing about poetry. I have no level of sophistication there. My own tastes run to the shorter poems of Ogden Nash, and on that level, I would like to quote the late Mr. Nash. One of my favorite poems. Shake and shake the ketchup bottle. None'll come, and then a lot'll. We are talking about shaking the NEH ketchup bottle today, so let's go. Many of you probably know this group more likely from your contact with the Arts Endowment than with our Humanities Endowment, that the two endowments were created in 1965 as part of the Great Society program. If you're a little foggy on how the humanities are defined, you've got lots of company. Congress, in its infinite wisdom in the mid-1960s, decided to define the humanities by enumerating a number of academic disciplines that they thought covered the humanities. And so I'm very proud that in 7 years at NEH, I have not memorized this. I have to read it. The term humanities includes, but is not limited to, the study of the following disciplines: history, philosophy, languages, linguistics, literature, archaeology, jurisprudence, the history, theory, and criticism of the arts, and I might stress that one for this audience, the history, theory, and criticism of the arts, comparative religion, and then here comes the rubber clause at the end, and those aspects of the social sciences that employ historical or philosophical approaches. I'm fond of saying that that covers a multitude of sins in academe nowadays. Anyway, that's what the humanities are, as I will be using the term today. NEH is a small agency by federal standards. We have about 225 employees, a budget of about $177 million. I don't think you can buy a toilet in a B-1 bomber for $177 million. So that kind of puts us in perspective there. Some people, I think, are intimidated by both endowments, not only because we're federal and way out there, all carrying our briefcases and wearing blue pinstripe suits in the hallways of the federal bureaucracy, but because we do split very readily into divisions and in those divisions into offices to the point where it can become a maze, and the poor citizen who is trying to approach his or her government to get some of those public funds looks at this bureaucratic morass and says, no, not for me. My main message to you today will be, certainly don't let that happen to you in connection with NEH, and I will be saying more about that as we go along. Now, people who are interested in sound collections might actually benefit at NEH in a number of ways, or from approaching a number of those divisions and offices that I just mentioned. Just because I'm the person talking to you today does not mean that my program is the only one that could possibly have an interest in recorded sound collections. That's certainly not true. Just without getting into the business of giving you the whole organizational tree of NEH, just to show you how sound collections might connect with different units of NEH, I can say that the Division of Research, for example, its constituency is scholars. People doing advanced work in the humanities disciplines. It helps with publication. It helps with professional conferences. If you hear a potential entree there for work in recorded sound or the interpretation of recorded sound, then yes, I think research might be worth talking to. The Division of Education is primarily interested in teacher training at all levels. But they also get into curricular matters every now and then, and I know right now they have a CD-ROM project down there for Shakespearean performances that I believe they think is going to have a curricular impact at the high school and college level. So if you hear potential there for recorded sound collections, yes, you might want to talk to that division. Preservation and Access, the Division of Preservation and Access, as you would expect, preserves the intellectual content of all sorts of important research collections, and sound is one of them. And by the way, that office has gotten money hand over fist from Congress in recent years, and they are fat cats up there. We're envious of them. So if you are sitting on top of unique resources, intellectual resources that would be of importance to the community of scholars as a whole in this country and internationally, and you have conservation problems, think about talking to the Division of Preservation and Access. Fellowships and seminars, that again supports the work of individual scholars, and if those scholars happen to be working in recorded sound, it supports them too. So there's potential money there. I come from the Division of Public Programs. Our constituency is the out-of-school public audience, the layperson, often adult audiences, but we are also interested in programming for young people and children during their out-of-school hours. In the Division of Public Programs, we have a media program, which some of you are probably familiar with, that finances the planning, writing, and production of television and radio programs for public broadcast. And you've seen that NEH logo on your various PBS stations following, I don't know, Ken Burns' Civil War series and many other big programs that program of our division has had a hand in. In libraries and archives where I work, we usually think in terms of paper, but not necessarily. We would certainly be open to grant inquiries from recorded sound collections. Most often we have done exhibitions, I suppose, and what we call reading and discussion programs. They could equally well be listening and discussion programs, and we'll talk to you a little bit about one of those in a minute. As a matter of fact, let's do that right now. The best recorded sound-based project that has been funded by the program in which I work, Libraries and Archives, to date has been the Poets in Person project done jointly by the American Library Association and the Modern Poetry Association. That was a group of 13 cassette tapes along with various paraphernalia, a reader's guide, a listener's guide that I have over on the table, training for the scholars and librarians, a national workshop in this case, to train them to go back and lead discussions in their libraries. What these were interviews and poetry readings with some important modern-day poets: Rita Dove, Allen Ginsberg, Carl Shapiro, Maxine Kuhman, A.R. Ammons, Gwendolyn Brooks, and on and on and on. Those have been very successful, by the way. A lot of skeptics think that any public interest in poetry is dead and buried in this country. These tapes and the discussions that have grown out of them have proved that that is absolutely not the case, that the power of poetry still has an allure, even media-jaded though we all may be. Could music be used? I can hear someone wondering. Yes. Here it becomes a matter of how to put a humanities spin on music interpretation. Our friends in the Arts Endowment are the ones who are responsible for music appreciation per se, the pure aesthetics of the thing. If, however, you can envision ways in which music, let's say popular song lyrics, might be used to teach lessons about social and cultural history in a given time period, that is potentially a humanities spin on music. And you can readily see, I think, how a music tape with attitudes reflected about race, gender, whatever, could easily become a text for a group discussion about some important social and cultural history. That would be how to do music a la the humanities. So my creative challenge to you is, do you have material like that you would like to use in that type of education? If you would like to wing some potential topics at me during the question period, I'm quite willing to give you an off-the-cuff response as to whether I think they would be competitive or not. Again, since it's so important with this audience that I get this arts and humanities great divide separated, and it's so difficult to separate, thank goodness, I would say, but a friend of mine has an anecdote about graphic art. He says, if you have a large painting with a small label underneath, that's the arts. If you have a small painting with a large label underneath, that's the humanities. The trick is then to get your recorded sound with a large label underneath. Now, that might come at in a discussion situation, such as we've been talking about, in a live performance situation. It could even come in a pre-performance or post-performance discussion. There are many ways that might be done. It's just important that the music be not only appreciated for its beauty, but that it incite thought somehow. Okay. What are your chances if you shake the ketchup bottle in the Libraries and Archives program where I work? The short answer is about 30%. We fund about 30% of the applications we receive. We award two kinds of grants in our program. We have little planning grants, which are designed to help people who have a good idea, usually bring consultants together to plan out a full implementation proposal in more detail. Those little planning grants run between $20,000 and $35,000. They are usually for periods of 6 months, and the assumption is at the end of a planning period that has been funded by us, you will come forward with a full-scale implementation proposal, which you would also like us to fund. Those implementation proposals can last for periods of up to 3 years. A typical award size range in implementation runs between $20,000 and $350,000. How many of those do we get? NEH, big national agency, highly competitive. Planning grants, I think we get on the average about 20 to 25 a year. Full-scale implementation proposals for the big money, super competitive, I don't have a chance there. About 55 a year, I would say, in our program, and we fund 30% of those. So your chances may not be anywhere near as remote as you think. It's that bureaucratic image, I think, that intimidates people, and it's only in sessions like this that we can really get out and beg and plead the public to come to us to ask questions. As Holly said a minute ago in her introduction, one of my favorite things is teaching people how to write grants. If you call me and say, I'd like to brainstorm just blue sky about something for a while, I don't know whether this could turn into anything or not, that's not a bother to me. That's a central portion of my job and a very satisfying portion if it happens to lead to something. It's a particularly great thrill to me to work with a small institution in competition with the big boys and to have so much back and forth editorial critique and counseling with those people that they actually win and beat the big boys. That gives me a big thrill. Inexperienced applicants are welcome. Critiques of multiple drafts are welcome. My personal record at this point is I critiqued 18 drafts of a particular proposal. It was funded to the tune of $250,000, and a bunch of people in Rhode Island made me a folk hero for about a week. We will be glad to advise you about the language to use, the arguments that appeal to the panelists who sit in judgment on our proposals, what they like to see, what they don't like to see. We will send you samples of funded proposals if you ask for them. That evaluation process is a bit complex, too, and I suppose at a meeting like this one, there would be a good deal of curiosity about who makes up these panels who will sit in judgment on my recorded sound proposal. Will there be any recorded sound people on that panel to speak for this? The short answer to that is not necessarily. We convene two panels a year right now. They are very general panels that must judge a wide range of topics and a wide range of program formats. What we will do if we feel that group doesn't contain the expertise to hand down a legitimate decision on your proposal is we will also seek specialized outside review, and in that case we could go get recorded sound folk to give us their opinion, and that would also be weighed in the evaluation process. panel and reviewer comments then go to the National Council on the Humanities. That's 26 private citizens appointed by the president, confirmed by the Senate. And ultimately, the buck stops with the chairman of the endowment. Sheldon Hackney right now has ultimate congressional authority to say yay or nay on any given proposal. Ordinarily, I will say that the judgments of panelists and reviewers, that holds up a tremendous majority of the time. I would say 90% of the time, whatever the panelists and reviewers said comes to pass. In conclusion, when it comes to NEH, don't assume, ask. Even if the published guidelines appear to exclude what you want to do, a call might be worth it. We will talk to you about how to shake our ketchup bottle. We're not protective of it at all. The more proposals, the better, as far as we're concerned. I will be glad to act as a point of entry person for ARSC members with questions about the endowment. My telephone number. By the way, on each corner of the stage down here, I have put some copies of the guidelines to the program in which I work, a little overview booklet of the endowment that's very useful. And then there's a little form there that we call a luggage lightener. It's for those of you who, you know, don't want to do one of these all the way home and would like to send to the endowment for various publications. If we run out of those, and we may, here comes my telephone number again. Area code 202-606-8271, and I will be back in the office as early as tomorrow. That's it. The questions can be more important than the talk at a session like this, and I know that and like to leave an ample period for questions for that reason. Anyone?
I work on the other end of what you do. I do work in fulfillment of grants for various people as a sound restoration engineer. I also help people frame up budgets and the like to get some picture of how much they need to accomplish their proposing. I don't help in the writing of the grant, that's another hand. But I've, in recent years, heard the attitude many times, more times than you'll be comfortable with anyway, that unless the project is extremely glitzy or is of a name performer or a name organization that is very much in the general public light rather than in the specialist public light, that the institution, and it's mostly institutions with whom I work, have the point people have commented or actually stated, not even vaguely elliptically, that we're wasting our time. Because the panels have made up with people who are much more concerned with other technologies than those that are strictly audio, and that their competitive nature of the attempts to get funding for projects often founders on but this is video or this is film and is therefore more universally applicable to exploitation later. This is actually, I think, a function of the general shift towards the pictorial. And it's, I think, a consequence of the change, using television as a babysitter for many of these people, rather than radio as the babysitter. Regardless of that, the consequences, I think, are that people in audio, in many cases, don't even bother applying for grants.
Okay.
In part because they feel that the time they waste in preparing them is better spent doing some other work within the library. I appreciate your comments on that.
Okay. There were several things there that were helpful that prompted thoughts. The first is the business about is it worth the money to take the time to write a grant? That's a difficult question, and certainly no one I know at NEH would attempt to tell you that writing grants for us is easy money. Someone made up a rule of thumb a long time ago, I don't remember who it was in our agency, to the effect that there are about 80 hours of time in the writing of a grant proposal. We shake our heads at that in amazement and say, I don't know how anyone could write a successful proposal for us in 80 hours unless they'd done it before and knew exactly what we were looking for. It is a long and arduous process. Whether it is worth the time or whether your internal staff time would be better invested in processing collections or in helping patrons, that's a question that only you can ask. It's a little bit like doing research, I suppose. For some scholars, doing research is a joy. It's a recreative type of activity. It's a lift. For others, it's tedious. It's something that I have to do so that I can get the publication done. Maybe there's a parallel there in writing grants. If the intellectual work of pulling a coherent grant, an interpretive, thematic kind of grant proposal together, if that's fun for you, if your mind responds positively to that, I would say then, even though it's probably going to take a lot of hours, where there's a will, there's a way. On the other hand, if that's pushing a large rock up a steep hill for you, and meanwhile you've got patrons that you can't serve or backlogged materials that are piling up, if you come to it with a chip on your shoulder, my advice would probably be that you're probably not ever going to do it well enough to be competitive. I hope that speaks to part of your comment. Another thing that you started to get into there was the business of whether my collection has to be of huge national significance to even come forward to a federal funding agency. The short answer to that is not necessarily. It depends on what kind of project you want to do. For our program, if you can bring us something done with locally significant materials, but which is so coherent and persuasive intellectually that it jumps right off the page at the panelists, you may be competitive. Yes.
My name is Leonard Lau. My organization is very much concerned with
Yes.
I can answer that.
Oh, do.
And it'll follow with a question. The three proposals that ARSC has submitted and had approved to the National Endowment for Humanities included two in research resources and one in preservation. And I think they were in part successful for two reasons that we'll need comment from our speaker on. One, they were, all three of them were consortia projects. That is, they brought together a number of institutions working together on a project. And secondly, ARSC itself served as the umbrella organization and charged no overhead in carrying out the projects in terms of administrative expense and so forth. So we carried out a proposal funded by NEH called Audio Preservation, a Planning Study, submitted at the end of that an 860-page report back to NEH, which is being used today in various places. It is still available. But the question that comes to that, would you comment on the relative degree of success today of non-consortium project proposals as opposed to those submitted by consortia? And then secondly, is there still an advantage from the endowment's point of view of having an umbrella organization like ARSC sponsor such projects, whether they're consortia or individual?
Okay, let me get back to this one down front first. In terms of having knowledge of specific projects off the top of my head that have been done by the Division of Preservation and Access recently, I can't do that. I can give you my impression of a sort of general evolution of preservation consciousness up there as I've seen it. They started big on newspapers, which they've been doing newspaper microfilming since back before it was fashionable. They're still going whole hog on that, but they've now realized that material culture, that artifacts, are in trouble too. So that's the second step they took. Just recently, we have been seeing a lot of photographic preservation, digitalization-type projects up there. So my surmise is that once they get set with photo digitalization, they will be ready to move to sound. I don't think they've done it yet, but really, since I am not closely involved with the work of that division, that's just a subjective view. To the back now. Consortia, yes. If you are cooperating with other institutions, that will generally be an advantage in writing any proposal to NEH. Does that mean you have to cooperate? No, you don't. Your institution can do it alone. The business of umbrella organizations is particularly handy in that NEH requires the financial administrators of a project to have nonprofit status with the IRS. And so you can sometimes, even if you're an individual, you can work through an organization that does have IRS 501c status, and that's a good reason for cooperating. Yes?
I think the Eastman Rochester project,
the archive project, was the NEH funded project.
I don't know. You could well be right.
The Eastman School of Music did get two grants from Preservation and Access in 1989, a two-year project, and in 1992, for preservation of sound recordings.
Tell us a little bit about those.
We focused on Howard Hanson materials and festivals of American music, American compositions from 1930s through, in the first phase, it was through about 1950, it was our discs, and then in our second project, we moved on to our acetate tape. And we were funded to do the preservation and cataloging of those materials.
Was the effort that it took to write the grant worth the payoff that the grant brought to you?
Well, it was worth it because that's the only way we were able to preserve those materials. It is vastly time-consuming to write a proposal.
There's a good hedged answer for you. Yes.
The Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers had a preservation, had a cataloging project and then later a preservation project approved by the endowment. And I'm not certain of the outcome of the most recent Country Music Foundation proposal, but it is my assumption that there was at least one approved by the endowment for the Country Music Foundation.
Yes.
I know that accessibility cataloging material can be an issue for many divisions, and I'm wondering what the attitude is towards cataloging that material onto the internet and having it available that way versus the more standard academic national databases.
Okay. Access projects are something that would belong in a division other than mine, but I can give your question a general answer. They are certainly willing to do cataloging access type projects. The critical factor there will be the uniqueness of that material and its relative importance to the community of scholars. If you've got a really good batch of stuff that once it is cataloged and arranged and put online would attract lots of inquiries and lots of use from the scholarly community, then you've got a strong case for that type of project in the Division of Preservation and Access. Yes?
To speak to your own particular program and to point out that small organizations may have trouble, but so do big ones. In this building, we have a very active program of exhibitions and public programming, which goes to public programming in this auditorium every day, free exhibitions, which I hope you have toured the building and seen, which are perfectly wonderful right now. Sometimes these have an important audiovisual component. However, to apply to you for any funding first requires that we get over the hurdle of the local competition within the organization, because the endowments have a limit on how many proposals they will take from a single organization. Then you have to get over the hurdle of the fact that you're in New York. And if you were in Idaho, you'd be a lot better off.
In more ways than one.
Would it be worth, you know, our time to spend the 2 months solid work writing the proposal? Probably not, because we wouldn't ever even get to you.
If what you're saying is that within your own organization there is a limit on how many proposals can come forward to NEH, that I don't know about. If what you're saying is that NEH has a limit on how many proposals it will accept from your organization, you are dead wrong. Yes, ma'am. No. Who told you that, please?
Perhaps I am confusing NEH and NEA. Okay. NEA, I know, will only take 3, and it will only take 3 from the biggest possible umbrella that they can put you under.
If when you get back to your office you find that that was NEH and you can tell me where you got that information, I will see that that person gets into a great deal of trouble if I possibly can. Because that's not true. The business about geographic distribution and would you be better off coming in from Idaho, we're still an amazingly provincial country, and you can see that from Washington. People coming in from the Deep South are absolutely convinced that NEH is run by Yankees and that they don't have a chance. People coming in from the West Coast are absolutely convinced that we're all effete Easterners and that their projects don't have a chance. People coming in from the Rocky Mountains, say, or from the northern tier, think that because they only have population to the tune of maybe 100 people for every 100 square miles, that they can't compete. So everybody's got an idea of why they are geographically or demographically at some kind of disadvantage. Again, all I can say is call and ask. I will give you a straight answer on that, and lots of my colleagues, to my certain knowledge, will also. That's a good question, though. Stereotypes about what NEH does and doesn't do and who's out to get you, that's part of the intimidation factor that could be just a bunch of hooey, and that it would be real easy to break through. Yes.
I would just like to follow up on Steve's question. Do you think we should be concerned that there be a visual component in what we propose? Is it really enough to just present, you know, audio projects?
Speaking of the Libraries and Archives program, my program now, what would be good there probably is what Poets in Person did, and this is the listener's guide that went with that set of cassette tapes that I mentioned a while ago. This has extra poems in it. It has bibliographic suggestions in it. One of the priorities, the mission of our program, is to try and enhance public appreciation and use of library collections. So if the sound component that you send us also then entails some kind of library collection use in other areas, perhaps they would go read as a result of what they had heard, tying sound to other media in that way would be strategically advantageous, yes.
About individual applications, which perhaps is not so much in your territory, back when I was doing mine, all those who applied were asked to provide 3 readers for the proposal, and I understood then, and I believe it may still be the case in individual proposals, that the outside readings are normally obtained and that they can weigh very heavily. The selection process. Can you give any advice to individuals on this?
The short answer is no. I believe different divisions of NEH, and this is another thing I guess that the public doesn't realize, we are all our own little kingdoms, even within a small agency like ours. We have different procedures in different divisions for doing things. It becomes very frustrating, frankly, sometimes, but that's the reality of it. I don't know. Did you have a fellowship? Is that what?
Research. It was a research grant.
Okay. The Division of Research, I believe, does still use the method of inviting you to name people who would be qualified readers of your proposal. We do not do that in the Division of Public Programs.
As a librarian, it seems to me that we're thinking more and more about ways to bring the collection out to the public rather than to bring the public into the collection. And is there a correlation in the kinds of proposals you're seeing?
If what you're asking is in inviting public appreciation and use of my collections, does that mean that my little 100 square foot facility is going to be overrun by hordes of, you know, screaming public users? No, not necessarily. If your grant creates a grant product package that can stand alone and be appreciated, and your holdings appreciated sort of secondarily or by reflection, that is as much hands-on as it has to be. If you're worried about fragile materials in all of this, or recordings that simply could not be played too many times, NEH is not advocating that you destroy those in the name of trying to make them publicly accessible. Did I miss your point?
No. I guess if someone were doing a project that was funded through preservation and access, to my mind, they've done part A. B is how do you now reproduce the thing that you preserved and get it out to whoever wants it whenever they want it?
Yes.
And is this now much more important than it was even 10 years ago?
Are we seeing lots more of those types of proposals? Not that I'm aware of. The number of sound collection-based proposals coming to my program was near zero and is still there. I happen to know that over in the media program in our division, where they do the big television and radio productions, their total number of applications is off in recent years. We see a paradoxical situation at NEH whereby when the economy gets stale, instead of resulting in more applications to us, that results in fewer applications to us. And I think the economy still has not reheated as far as our grant cycles are concerned. Yes?
That Holly's question brings up one point, and then your comment brings up a second one. Holly's question concerns the use and distribution of material, which brings up a whole question of copyright. I don't know how much you care to go into that. The second point is the method of preservation, and that brings up the question of digital versus analog storage and what your policies, official and unofficial, may be concerning the use of these in the processes.
The copyright question is fairly easily addressed, and that is in the projects we fund, if copyrightable materials are created, that copyright rests with the creator, not with NEH. Now, in some instances where there is reason to believe that there will be a big commercial value to something after the project is done, that it will go on selling on its own, the Ken Burns' Civil War tapes are a good case in point. The NEH may attach a clause whereby it can recover a portion of that up to the amount of money that it put in the project in the first place. And then after that, the copyright reverts wholly to Burns or whomever. So you're on safe copyright ground as far as that goes. The analog digital thing, I am not technically qualified to answer that question. Yes.
I understand you to say that NEH might be interested in the dissemination of local music from one library to a series of libraries for educational purposes?
Possibly, yes, if the interpretation of that music teaches important lessons about the human condition that are No, stay away from the technicalities of music, if you will. That, again, is the purview of the Arts Endowment.
I'm sorry, that was the last question. Thank you very much, David. Thank you very much.